Good morning. I'm Michael Green, the Senior Advisor, Japan Chair here, and also on the faculty at Georgetown. Senator Murkowski is on her way. She's the first native-born Alaskan senator. I don't think the weather is slowing her down, but some work in the Senate. And here we go. Good. It is therefore my perfect timing, Senator. my distinct privilege to introduce our first keynote speaker, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. The senator joined the Senate in 2002. As I was mentioning earlier, the first Alaskan-born senator in the United States Senate, and therefore I was explaining the weather was not, I'm certain, the reason for your being a little bit late, and we're delighted you're here. Senator Murkowski is the sixth senator from Alaska to the United States Senate. She has key assignments in the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. She is the ranking member on the Asia-Pacific Subcommittee of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Her law degree is from Willamette University, and I'm pleased to say her bachelor's is from Georgetown University, where I teach. Senator Murkowski, like her father, like Senator Stevens, carries on a very important tradition for the United States, wherein distinguished senators from Alaska and often from Hawaii keep us focused on the Asia-Pacific region, while the rest of the country often lets its gaze drift to the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, and Europe. I've had the honor of testifying before the senator in the Asia-Pacific subcommittee, and she's kept a very keen watch and a strategic perspective on the entire region and on key issues, including developments in Burma recently, the North Korea problem. So we're delighted to have the senator speak to us today on the U.S. perspective on East Asian economic integration. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and good morning, and I do apologize. I can't blame the weather. I'm blaming it on everybody else and their confusion this morning that caused a little bit of a delay. But I'm delighted to have the opportunity to address you this morning and give you the perspective. And I do appreciate the introduction that recognizes the ties between my home state of Alaska and our neighbors in Japan and within the region. With the conclusion of the third East Asia Summit in Singapore, this is, I think it's a very timely forum. The topic of this forum should certainly catch the attention of not just the policymakers here in Washington, but also all of those states, Alaska, but all of those states that have considerable economic ties to the region as well. Now, the natural tendency when we think of East Asia's potential economic integration from a U.S. perspective is to perhaps view it as if we are on the outside looking in. But greater economic integration in East Asia, however, does not have to be seen as a negative. It can lead to greater stability in the region, and I guess to borrow the words of Bob Zelick, it can make each nation more of a stakeholder in the region's and the world's economy. Now, certainly from Alaska's point of view, we already are economically integrated with East Asia. Alaska's three largest trading partners are in Asia. That's Japan, South Korea, and China. Canada, the nation that we share a land border with, is our number four trading partner. It was back in 1965 that Alaska became the very first of all the states to open a trade office in Japan. Our timber industry in the southeastern part of the state, quite honestly, would not have started without the Japanese investment. We recognize the ties to the trade there. Within the state, we've been exporting coal to South Korea for 22-plus years now. Now. Comparatively, China is probably a late arriver, but our trade, Alaska's trade with China, has more than quadrupled since 2002. 10% of Alaska's economy is dependent on trade, and 2/3 of that trade occurs within the Asia-Pacific region. So you can see that the ties there are quite close. We're a state that is extremely rich in our natural resources, but we're short on manufacturing, we're short on refining capacity. So for our economy to function, our raw materials must be exported to be processed. For products such as seafood, our timber, our minerals, we so very often look to East Asia. So with that as a little bit of a background, it is understandable that given our geographic location and sometimes our political leanings, those of us in Alaska often feel as if we're closer to Asia than we are here to the folks in Washington, D.C. And why the talks of Asian economic integration to the potential detriment of the United States certainly garners our attention. When it comes to the trade, the United States' push for regional and for bilateral free trade agreements was in part viewed as a way to move the rest of the world forward, to make others feel as if they would be falling behind if global talks did not progress. But with the question marks surrounding the status of the Doha Round, it's not certain just how much further the international community is willing to go in trade liberalization. We need to be sure that the free trade agreements are not only economically and politically beneficial for the involved parties, but that they also fit into the United States' broader trade agenda. So a question that should be asked is, or what we should look at, is in which direction has our push for regional and bilateral free trade agreements moved Asia? Now, I would argue that East Asia's move to create its own economic region is in part our own doing here in the United States. When we signed NAFTA, that was a wake-up call to our Asian allies about the direction of our trade policy. The push to conclude a free trade agreement of the Americas was an even stronger signal. And then, of course, the passage of CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, only serves as confirmation. Well, the Singapore FTA and the pending South Korea FTA help, there is an impression that the United States is focused on the Western Hemisphere and not our Asian trading partners. As former Japanese Prime Minister Ryotaro, Hashimoto said, if the United States strengthens its posture towards forming a protectionist bloc by extending NAFTA and closing off South America and North America, then Japan will have to emphasize its position as an Asia-Pacific country. Please do not force us into such a corner. Now, following the Asian financial crisis of 1997 and 1998, the United States' behavior was regarded in Asia as evidence that the region needed to take care of itself, to develop its own institutions and integrate its economy to take care of Asian nations first. The chairman's statement from the East Asia Summit reiterated the participants' decision to deepen regional cooperation. The statement noted that deepening economic integration is a key element in promoting regional community building. A formal report on comprehensive economic partnership in East Asia is expected to be submitted at the next East Asia Summit in Thailand. But we should keep in mind that the chairman's statement noted that the East Asia Summit was only a component of the emerging regional architecture and would play a complementary role with other forums in the region, such as ASEAN and APEC. Our Asian partners are not ready to completely replace the United States in the region, at least not yet. We look at the recent visit from Japan's new prime minister. He chose the United States as the destination for his first overseas visit, reaffirming Japan's close relationship with the U.S. But we've got a fissure that remains between China and Japan. A Yomiuri Shimbun survey from this past September showed that a majority of Chinese regard Japan as the greatest military threat to them. As long as the two largest economies in Asia remain divided, the ability for East Asia to economically integrate itself will be difficult to achieve. As long as there is competition between nations for oil and gas, for those energy resources, economic integration will be that much more challenging. Can you imagine here in the United States if all of our 50 states competed with each other for energy resources? Now, from Alaska's perspective, that may be a tempting thought. We're certainly in a very strong position, but that's aside. Well, it would be easy for policymakers in the U.S. to view greater economic integration within East Asia as a threat to our trade influence in the region. It's my contention that it provides us with the opportunity to give our own trade agenda a much-needed jumpstart. Now, in 2002, when Congress granted the President trade promotion authority, it was against a backdrop of concern that the U.S. was falling behind other nations in negotiating free trade agreements to obtain favorable trading conditions. And at that time, the U.S. was a party to just three free trade agreements. This was the NAFTA free trade, Israel, and Jordan. Other nations were moving forward with trade agreements at a much, much faster pace. In order to catch up and ensure our own companies could compete in foreign markets, it was viewed as imperative for Congress to renew the President's ability to negotiate free trade agreements with the assurance of consideration by Congress with an up or down vote. But today, that sense of urgency has waned significantly. When the President's trade promotion authority expired at the end of June, it was kind of met with a shrug or a ho-hum. There's clearly no hurry in Congress for its renewal at this time. If the topic of trade and Asia is brought up on Capitol Hill nowadays, it's most likely to turn to currency issues with China, beef exports to Japan and to South Korea, increased sanctions on Burma, or ensuring that nations live up to their WTO commitments. In other words, talk of trade takes on a negative tone rather than an acknowledgement of what the benefits could be. And with the politics of next year's presidential election already at hand, I don't believe that we're going to see that tone likely to change. When you have a dominant entity in any arena, whether it's sports or business or politics, when it sees its competitors gaining ground and becoming more competitive, the entity can either bicker amongst each other about whose fault it is, or they can adapt and find new ways to be a winning team. That's the challenge that we're facing in Washington today. Do we adapt or do we bicker? So far, the latter has been the approach of choice. There is, however, a growing recognition that the United States' economic influence around the world is in a downward trend. The emergence and growth of China and India, both participants in the East Asia Summit, has given nations across the globe, and particularly in the East Asia region, an economic alternative to the United States for investment and for market potential. Already, New Zealand is poised to finalize a free trade agreement with China, becoming the first developed nation to do so. And yet the U.S. will not enter into FTA negotiations with New Zealand. So can you blame them or really any other nation for looking elsewhere? If you don't like the strings that are attached, that the U.S. ties to foreign assistance. There are some nations that are more than willing to provide investment capital without requiring progress on human rights issues or government transparency. Are you concerned about sanctions from the Western world? As long as you have the energy resources or occupy a strategic location, countries will continue to invest. My intention this morning is not necessarily to point fingers or condemn other nations' trade policies or their foreign policy decisions. It's merely to note that even without economic integration in East Asia, as economies in the region develop and expand, the United States must decide whether we're going to stand still in our trade agenda and watch others pass us by, or whether we're going to ramp up our engagement to maintain our relevance. Are we going to provide our friends and our allies in Asia with a reason to continue their engagement with us? Or do they need to look elsewhere for their economic growth? Now, over the past several years, much of Washington's focus and attention has been on the Middle East and on Iraq and Iran and certainly the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. All these most certainly warrant our attention. But we have done so, I believe, to the detriment of our relations in Asia and particularly in Southeast Asia. We need to re-engage, and that starts with our friends and with our allies. I'm reminded of a meeting that I had with a visiting delegation from Australia. This wasn't too long ago, and their one basic request was, they said, we understand that there's a lot of issues going on around the world that the U.S. must pay attention to, is paying attention to, and rightly so, but please don't forget us. They said, just please don't forget us down here. And that remains a very valid point. Often, we tend to ignore our friends when things are going well to focus on the hot spots around the world. But we've got to remember that just as important as fighting the fires is making the time to prevent the unnecessary fires from starting in the first place. If we're going to invest, or if we're willing to invest in the prevention side, then the potential economic integration within East Asia does not need to be seen as a threat to the United States. But if we do not view this as a wake-up call, then it is the United States and quite honestly, states like my state of Alaska that depend very heavily on trade that will be on the outside looking in. So just as in 2002, when members of Congress were concerned that we were falling behind the rest of the world in our trading rights, members must again be concerned that if we don't move forward, or if protectionist steps are taken, Asian nations will have no choice but to look to other Asian nations for their trade relationships and their economic development. Let's not force them into that corner. I thank you for your time this morning. I don't know what our schedule is. I think we might have time for our question if that's appropriate. But again, I thank you for the opportunity to provide a few words this morning. Thank you. I'd be happy to. If there's
time for questions, if you identify yourself.
Thank you.
We have a microphone.
Thank you, Mike. Senator Murkowski, I'm Bernard Gordon, University of New Hampshire. I really appreciated your reference to former Prime Minister Hashimoto when he said, as you noted, that the United States, that was in a comment he made to Kissinger, who was visiting, and I'm sure you've read into that. Mm-hmm. But I'm troubled by, you seem to have led us to the view, which is one I share, to the view that these FTAs, as you said, are our own doing, in the sense they've come back to bite us. And yet you did not, in my view, indicate what is the next step. So let me lay out what I think needs to be a next step and get your reaction to that. I know this is going to be a difficult case to make, but a number of us believe, as you have indicated, that the bilaterals and the regionals are not the right way to go, that the only alternative is to undertake a full court press to see to it that that enormous difficulty of the 147-member WTO succeed and do more than it has, because that's the only visible alternative to the bilateral and the regional FTAs. So please, I hope you will give us your reaction to that, the searching for what is the answer.
The reason I have not proposed an answer or a fix or a way forward is I think we are still attempting to discern what that way forward is. And as I mentioned in my comments, so much of the focus with trade agreements has been on the Western Hemisphere at the expense of what we see within the Asian region. So how do we get the attention? I don't think we want to gain the attention by being the troublemaker, but I think it is one of the ways where, through our policies, that is how you get the attention, how you do attempt to move forward an initiative. So I haven't proposed a solution. Your response about it being truly, truly comprehensive is, as you cite, difficult, but is that the direction that we most likely should take for really not only the betterment of the region, but for our trade relationships in this country? I would suggest that you're probably right. How we get there, it'll be interesting to see how this is discussed in the presidential races within these next 10 months, and how much of a focus through the elections we actually have to this issue. And I think after November of next year, we might have a better indication as to the direction that we might be going. I'd say right now it's very much in a state of flux.
Masahiro Sakamoto, Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. I have the impression that the current administration too much involved in the Middle East and neglect the, you see, East Asia. So what can we expect, that some change in policy stance in the next, you see, president? How do you think?
Well, I'm not running for president, and I haven't even decided who I'm going to support for the presidency.
U.S. policy as a general, what is the impression? You are too much in neglect Asia at the expense of, you said at the expense of Western Hemisphere, but at the expense of Middle East. Mm-hmm. That's my impression.
Well, I share your impression. I do believe that we have lost the focus in many parts of the globe because of all the attention that is directed at the Middle East. And we understand the timing and why all eyes are upon the Middle East. But we can't afford to put all of our eggs in one basket, so to speak. We have to be players globally. And my concern, and what I have shared with you this morning, is that we have taken the focus. We have taken for granted the relationships, the long-standing relationships that we have had in Asia, and we do so at our own peril. I don't think that it's wise. So there's a few of us that will keep banging the drum and saying, wait a minute, you can't just accept that all is fine, well, and good in another part of the globe, let's pay attention to all of our friends and allies. Probably have time for one more in the back there.
Thank you very much. My name is Washio, belonging to JETRO. Thank you very much anyway. My question is US FDA policies. If we scrutinize American FDAs with the countries from a viewpoint of Pacific Rim.
I'm having a very difficult time hearing up so, here.
Thank you very
That's
much. I would like to address a question regarding to US FDA policies. And if we scrutinize the countries, you have already had FDAs from a viewpoint of Pacific Rim area. You have already had the FDAs with Canada, Mexico, and the countries located on the Pacific side of Latin American continents. On the other hand, on Asian side, you have already had the FDA with Australia, Singapore, and now Korea, probably. And the vacuum area may be China and Japan. So my question is, how do you think about an idea? American FDA with China is a little bit problematic, but so far, Japan, US FDA idea. How do you think about it?
Well, as you point out, we have had, if you look at where the FTAs have been, again, it's Latin South America. We just yesterday afternoon approved a free trade agreement with Peru. Again, very consistent with where the focus has been. South Korea is on deck, if you will, but we seem to be doing everything chronologically in terms of when it was taken up. So we finished Peru. We then go next to Colombia and then Panama and then South Korea, whether or not there will be a push to get South Korea finished before, during the Bush administration here, how much of a commitment we have, I don't know. That particular free trade agreement has already come up in the presidential politics. One of the Democratic candidates has said that she opposes it. So whether or not there may be an effort to try to make that a political issue in the campaign in terms of where the candidates are on it, that I do not know. There is, as I mentioned in my comments, there was a real push within the Bush administration in these early years to move these free trade agreements going forward. What the attitude of the next administration will be, I simply do not have a crystal ball that gives me any greater information than any of the rest of us here in this room. That's why, from my perspective, I would like to see that free trade agreement with South Korea completed now, while you still have an emphasis on these agreements out of this particular administration. I just don't know what the future is going to hold for us in terms of trade after next year. So the time is ripe now to make things happen. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your time this morning, and thank you for all the good work that you do.
That was an excellent message for our domestic audience. I don't know how it resonates with our foreign audience, but be encouraged that there are people like Senator Murkowski who are keeping the focus on these issues from the position of leadership in the U.S. Senate. We will move smartly through the day and turn now to our next keynote speaker, who will give a Japanese perspective on East Asian economic integration. Taizo Nishimuro graduated from Keio University, joined Toshiba Corporation in 1961, became the CEO in 1996, the chairman of Toshiba in 2000, and he's been an advisor since. He is currently the CEO and president of the Tokyo Stock Exchange, was appointed chairman of the Tokyo Stock Exchange in June of 2005, became CEO and president in June of 2006, and he has numerous other responsibilities, not only in Japan, but across the Asia-Pacific region and the Pacific, as an advisor and a steward of Japan's international economic relations, including vice chairman of Keidanren, a senior advisor on commissions to the Ministry of Finance, former chairman of the U.S.-Japan Business Council, various advisory responsibilities with the government of Singapore. So we're honored that he's taken time to be here with us. We hope the Tokyo Stock Exchange is going to be okay with him absent, but we're delighted he's here today. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Nishimura.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Michael, for your very generous, extensive introduction of myself. But unfortunately, I have to make a correction. There are various questions, but one is I became chairman of the board again for Tokyo Stock Exchange, and I delegated the CEO position to the president that I have appointed back in June. So don't worry about that, the Tokyo Stock Exchange. It has been running in a good hand, and I don't have any worry except for those subprime-related problems. Well, yesterday, late in the afternoon, I arrived into the city and had dinner. And after the dinner, I received all those handout materials from two prominent professors who's going to be on the podium after my speech. One is Angan Hu, and the other is Professor Yoshino. And both handout materials are full of statistics and also the numerous numbers. So I have spent some time to eliminate most of those numerical parts of my speech original and wish to make some basic idea expression from my side. The degree of the economic interdependence within East Asia is notably high. Interregional trade in East Asia, ASEAN plus 3 plus Hong Kong and Taiwan, counts at approximately 56%, surpassing the 43% of NAFTA countries, and is edging towards the 62% of the European Union. This demonstrates that the economic achievement of GDP are not simply understood by adding up the total GDP for all the countries within the region. GDP also reflects the result achieved by cooperations between individual countries within the region. With the progress of globalization, the scope of global trade and investment is also growing. In these circumstances, economic globalization continues to develop, and with it, economic interdependence in a global economy. Given this, the stronger the cooperation between large economic regions, the greater the resulting trade and investment opportunities for the parties involved. The US and EU markets are the main importers of East Asian products. In parallel with this, the continued and rapid expansion of East Asian economy will create an enormous market for the United States and also for EU. In places, especially such as in China and India. With East Asian economic development, income levels will grow and individual consumer needs will increase. For countries outside the region, this creates a promising marketplace. Asian economic development will greatly benefit economies outside of the region. Putting it past glorious empires, aside, the East Asia has a relatively short history of growth when it comes to development of secondary and tertiary industry. The NEES countries were the first to make the transition to industrialization after Japan. In the post-1980s period, the ASEAN four, that original ASEAN, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Philippine FTZ, allowed a free trade zone, allowed direct investment, which stimulated economic development. Japanese industry had been active there in various forms since the 1950s, but after the 1985 Plaza Code and rapid yen appreciation that followed, investments in the ASEAN countries grew quickly. The reasons for Japan's presence in East Asia have slowly changed. During the 1990s, Japan entered into a long phase of structural depression, and Japanese industry sought to cut costs by developing facilities in parts of Asia that offered low-cost labor. This move also supported Asia's industrial development. Advanced industries were supported by efforts to develop intermediate product and final services, EMSs, and logistics services also advanced in the territory. Electronic manufacturers began to build ASEAN facilities in the 1980s or a little bit earlier, thanks to advances in modularization in production technologies for electronics. Electronic parts became increasingly generic. This supported a division of labor in the production process, with basic design taking place in Japan and final assembly of finished products in Asia, where labor costs were lower. Please allow me to take Toshiba as an example, which I'm very much familiar with. Toshiba's production of digital products illustrates the trend. In 2006, last year, 95% of PCs, 45% of our worldwide TVs, 49% of projectors, 94% of DVD players, recorders, and VCRs, and 76% of hard disk drives and optical disk drives were produced in ASEAN countries outside of Japan. With different stages of production of electronic products being carried out in different places, the construction of production facilities across Asia stimulated the creation of physical distribution network. This achievement of ASEAN SCM also allows Western companies to commission large-scale EMSs and other manufacturing companies. The example, like Flextronics International, the largest EMS at this point to develop and manufacturing products. As Asia ramped up manufacturing, the product it manufactured were exported to the developed countries of Europe, the United States, and Japan. This created a positive environment for fiscal policies favoring infrastructure development and resulted in investment in social infrastructure systems such as highways, airports, and ports. This kind of industrialization and infrastructure investment naturally stimulated individual consumer spending, and as a result, the ASEAN economies entered into a high growth period. Today, each part of Asia region has developed its own industry identity. Alongside this, the region has put in place a network of physical distribution for semi-finished goods. Singapore plays a strategic role in transportation, both as financial center and a physical distribution center, with its harbors and airports. Taiwan's development is centered on to production of electronics and mechanical goods. Korea's industry base was built on automobiles, steels, and other heavy industries, and also the electronics. India and Thailand are also cultivating automotive production. China has made advances overall in the every and all categories of the products. Especially southern and eastern China have made advances in petrochemicals, which supported the IT automobile industries. Petrochemical plants have been built and now supply materials for construction-related goods. Today, from a Japanese company's viewpoint, the attraction of Asia is no longer only cheaper labor. The establishment of infrastructure has brought with it the ability to promote advances in new industries. However, there are still vast areas of Asia that remain untouched by industrialization. While many of the workers of Asia cannot be called privileged, they are gifted with optimism and the determination to improve their lives. Building up production with those workers and seeing productivity improve will further motivate the corporate side and stimulate even greater gains. The high market demand for quality automobiles with low gas consumption has led to the development of electric gasoline hybrid and other types of vehicles. At the moment, North America still leads the total number of the automobile production in the world, but Asia is increasing production and moving to catch up. Automobile industries in Asia are usually developed with government support to create an industry that can stimulate other parts of the economy. Malaysia is a current example. So was Japan 50, 60 years ago. Most of Japan's offshore production of autos have been in the United States and Europe. But in last decade, the ratio in Asia has been growing. The quantity of automobiles that Japanese manufacturers produce at the Asian affiliate in Asia is growing very fast. The total number of units produced overseas was 6 million in 2000, and it has grown at the pace of 1 million per year since 2004. By 2005, the figure stood over 10 million units. Japanese automakers are produced in Japan approximately 10 million vehicles a year, a figure that is growing very slowly or negatively growing. In other words, the total production of Japanese automobile manufacturer is roughly split between Japan and overseas. For this overseas production, China, Thailand, and India have been remarkably developed by Japanese, European, and U.S. automotive market. If one company decides to build a facility in a certain place, it is not unusual for a supplier with a history of working with that company to build its own factory in the same region. In the beginning, local workers usually did not have very well-developed manufacturing skills, and so only simple parts were manufactured. The tendency at that time was to rely on Japan for advanced products. However, local workers improved with experience, and it is now possible for those facilities to supply advanced equipment. The auto industry has recently started to change, albeit slowly. First of all, electronic systems are increasingly replacing mechanical systems. There have also been significant advances in automotive-related information processing, the field known as telematics. As a result, auto manufacturers and electronics manufacturers have now new opportunity for collaboration. With the increase in electronics and auto manufacturing in Asia, demand for supply of materials for home appliances, IT equipment, and auto parts production facilities has grown. This is particularly true in China, where social infrastructure development of highways, airports, and ports, along with the investment of foreign enterprises, have promoted economic advancement and demand for a wide variety of parts, components, and materials. Back in 2001, China's share of world production of air conditioners, microwave ovens, and printers were estimated at over 30%. For other home electronics, the figure was more than half the world's total. During the 1990s, China's manufacturer opening stimulated advances, mostly driven by foreign enterprises, but more recently, local industries have also developed. For example, China's Guangdong province developed local industries supplying electronic equipment, IT products, toys, and other miscellaneous products for export as a result of commissioned production of plastics from a direct user. After 1980s, economic momentum in East Asia was stimulated by direct investment by foreign enterprises. Currently, there are various debates on the necessity and possibility of advancing government integration for the purpose of system harmony. I would like to express my personal opinion about this. To begin, many negative opinions about the realistic possibilities for an ASEAN alliance begin by contrasting Asia with the EU. First, the European Union is a democracy with common tradition in many areas, such as Christianity, Indo-European language with roots in Latin and Greek, as well as general use of alphabet. Over the course of history, the European continent had been battleground for many times. But after the Second World War, there was a deep desire for permanent peace that came to outweigh each country's insistence on sovereignty. As a means of accomplishing this political goal, economic cooperation was encouraged, and under the 1951 Treaty of Paris, the European Coal and Steel Community was formed. That was the beginning of the long road to the EU. Asia is very much different. For a start, not all of the countries of Asia are democratic. The range of political systems covers communism, dictatorship, socialism, and different kinds of democracies. Religions range from Buddhist to Muslim to Hindu and beyond, varieties of them. Asia's many languages do not share common linguistic roots, and some countries have more than one official language. Depending on the estimate you accept, there are between 600 and 1,000 different race tribes in the region. There are also enormous differences in economic status between countries in the region. If you think about it realistically, if the cost of advancing government integration is a loss of Asia's diversity, the whole thing is negative. However, I'm sure that main issue concerning feasibility of the greater unification is not the diversity of the region or its economic inequalities. It is a lack of awareness on the part of governments of the need to integrate and to promote further legal systems cooperation. Institutional cooperation is necessary. The countries of the EU may have a lot in common to begin with, but the way that the current 27-member EU was created by facing and overcoming regional differences and economic imbalances. In its time, the United States also overcame such issues as immigration, civil war, the economic recession of the 1980s, and trade deficit, and has maintained itself as a beacon for talented and ambitious students and workers. In this respect, East Asia has much to learn from the United States and from the EU. Because the still developing East Asian region wants further economic growth, along with a desire for harmonized regulations and regional security opportunities for regional integration are growing. Currently, the only alliance within the Asian region is ASEAN. This year, 2007, ASEAN celebrated its 40th anniversary. On November the 20th, 2007, at Singapore Summit meeting, the ASEAN Charter was signed. It contains a blueprint for establishing an economic union by 2015, and this can be seen as a first step towards a regional alliance. Is Asia self-sustainable with only ASEAN? Is ASEAN self-sustainable with only ASEAN? In my opinion, ASEAN works only because of other countries. ASEAN works only because of other countries. There are currently discussions on the possibility of an ASEAN plus 3 or ASEAN plus 6. Debates on East ASEAN Economic Alliance began in 1991 at the meeting of East ASEAN Economic Cooperation in Malaysia. In 1997, at the time of ASEAN monetary crisis, the first ASEAN plus 3 summit was held. The abrupt devaluation of the Thai baht in 1997 and ensuing monetary crisis taught Asia important lessons. First, the World Bank did not have enough fund to save Asia from its crisis. Second, even the IMF, established as the world's financial security mechanism by the 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement, could not handle the crisis. The first lesson was that existing international systems could not produce a tailor-made solution to a unique ASEAN problem. The ASEAN monetary crisis taught a second lesson. Currently, due to economic and financial globalization, any significant regional event impacts on worldwide financial, stock, and economic trends. A recent example is the loss of suffered by EU and Japan and other ASEAN countries, inclusive the financial institutions in connection with the so-called subprime loan problem originated in the United States. This has raised concern over impacts at even the macroeconomic level. Establishing stability and guaranteeing regional security, as well as economic, industrial, and financial security, will not only be good for ASEAN region, there will also be a need for a mechanism for containing problems that arise in Asia, so they do not spill over into the United States or into Europe and the rest of the world. Learning from this experience, a failsafe against a recurrence of the monetary crisis was created. Financial cooperation of the East ASEAN countries within ASEAN plus 3, based on CMI, which is Chiang Mai initiative. This became the ASEAN Bond Fund and our initiative to create a bond market in Asia that would allow bilateral currency swap agreement of foreign loans. In 2005, the bilateral swap agreement secured $58 billion, and at June 2007, ASEAN plus 3 financial affairs ministry meeting, the total sum of the monetary swap fund was boosted to $80 billion. The remaining question now is whether or not this is enough. In order to be effective when a crisis unfolds, I would like to strongly insist the Chiang Mai Initiative power and the ASEAN Development Bank's financial power must be strengthened as quick as possible. The lesson of ECM monetary crisis do not end with currency. One thing made clear was that international mechanisms created by Europe and the United States are not necessarily the best solution for Asia's problems. Also, the ASEAN region's endemic diseases, its viruses included the avian flu that first appeared in Asia, and its weather are far beyond the WHO's support capabilities. East Asia may utilize the west of that theory of the subsidiarity applied by the EU. That is a principle which states that matters ought to be handled by the smallest competent authority included in the Maastricht Treaty. What can be done within the region must be done by the region. The region must be capable of solving its own problems. In the future, this approach will provide the basis for forming an ASEAN region. Do I have time, or I think better to quit? Can I continue? Okay. Multilateral currency cooperation within the ASEAN Plus 3 was created in response to the current occurrence of a real problem, the ASEAN monetary crisis, and it has continued to develop since. In that respect, it is a clear example of a realistic cooperation effort. However, in terms of ensuring East Asia's security and continued economic activity, there are plenty of opportunities beyond the framework of ASEAN Plus 3. Given this, and that the ASEAN Plus 3 already relies on India, Australia, and New Zealand, an effective step forward would be to include these countries in an ASEAN Plus 6. In addition, APEC-wide economic cooperation, including the United States, is also being considered. The Japanese economy is dependent on Japan and China. On the United States and China. The same way the United States is dependent on Japan and China. Japan and the United States also have a security treaty. In order to ensure security and economic stability in the ASEAN region, this US-Japan security treaty and other security treaties the United States have made with the other countries in Asia, those alliances should be pivotal. That means that the United States involvement is a must. As I have noted, several topics are now being considered in connection with creation of an East ASEAN Union. In the future, whatever framework is decided upon for the clear realization of that East ASEAN Union, continued promotion of economic integration, establishment of government and private sector joint meetings, US-Japan EPA, strengthening Sino-Japanese economic cooperation, and an APEC-wide trade framework will continue to be discussed. As a different approach, bilateral economic cooperation between the two countries, which is already signed, being extended to other countries, is another possibility. At this point, it is still too soon to determine the framework of East ASEAN Alliance. Just as a member of EU and NATO are different countries, reflecting different concerns, East Asia also may not be able to form a single alliance for security and economic cooperation. It is necessary for the countries of Asia to continue development. In order to do this, and to look at the many issues involved, many require the ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN Plus 6, and APEC to form many combinations. Until now, the rapid growth of China and India has often been seen as a threat. However, Japan wants to see healthy industrial and economic development in both countries. To that end, there should be no ill will about promoting all the cooperation necessary. One example of that cooperation would be working in cooperation with China and India to address their growing energy demand and environmental concerns. The United States and Japan have many various interdependent relationships. All pivoting on the security alliance. And it is much to be hoped that we can work together to overcome environmental problems. More specifically, we should reinforce our cooperation in creating an international framework for responding to global warming, environmental pollutions, and conservation and management of energy resources. We should also cooperate in systems harmonization, intellectual property protection, fair competition, and international immigration services. Well, I think this is the end. Thank you very much for listening. Yes, sure.
Thank you, Nishimura-san. I'm sorry I got your resume wrong. That's what happens with a very long and impressive resume. We have time for one or two questions, but I'm going to take the prerogative of my position here to ask the first. The driver for East Asian economic integration is largely the creation of these production networks across the region. There is also, of course, the push since the financial crisis and because of NAFTA on the political side. The financial cooperation in ASEAN Plus 3 mostly deals with debt swapping. It's government-led. My question is, to what extent does Asia need a global or a globally competitive financial center like London or New York to actually propel economic integration of the kind we see in the EU? And can Tokyo become that center?
Well, thank you very much for your excellent question, I would say. The question for the Tokyo Stock Exchange is its desire by the institution itself and also by the Japanese government that Tokyo should become the one of the financial centers in the world. But in reality, that although the market value of the listed companies at Tokyo Stock Exchange is number two next to New York NYSE Euronext combination. But the activities and growth is not that attractive. We are making all the effort to make Tokyo as an attractive financial center, and it might take time. We are making progress, but other countries are making progress also. It seems like there are various stock exchanges who has a future and also who has the potential to become a financial center. One actually is Singapore. Singapore declared that they are going to be the financial center of the entire Asia. And also Hong Kong, which is growing very rapid. And in addition to that, the Shanghai Exchange is growing. And those four, including Tokyo, are the candidates. And I think the competition in between those four will be a healthy thing for the future of Asia. Although Tokyo Stock Exchange never abandoned the desire to become the center of that. Thank you.
Maybe we have time for one more question before we take a break.
Paramis Warren from Agence France Presse. You mentioned just now that Asia must be capable of solving its own crisis, particularly in relation to the 1997 financial turmoil. At that time, Japan proposed, I think, to set up this Asian Monetary Fund, and there was a lot of objections from the United States. Do you think that the time is right now or ripe now for Japan to lead such a proposal, considering the fact that Japan is seen by many in the world that its democratic growth and financial might could help it play such a role? Thank you.
Well, that Asian Development Fund issue is a sticky issue still continues on. But I do not like to insist upon the creation of that Asian Development Fund. Professor Yoshino is more capable of explaining the effect of Japanese AIDS, the combined AIDS, to Asian countries during the financial problems. And I would like to say, as I insisted here, the expansion of Chiang Mai Initiative and also that enlargement of the capabilities and funds of Asian Development Fund, those two will be the key cornerstone for the future, utilizing already established institutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break. We have a series of distinguished speakers. The next panel will look at this blizzard of FTAs and EPAs in Asia, and we will try to sort it out with commentary from leading economists from the region and from the United States. Our plan was to then have Ambassador Pitsuan, the new Secretary General of ASEAN, speak, followed by Karan Bhatia, the former Deputy USTR, and previous to that, a senior official in the Department of Transportation. Ironically, one of Karan's key responsibilities was negotiating open skies agreements, particularly with Asia, to ease traffic, and Mr. Pitsuan's plane has been delayed, so we can later ask Karan if he had done enough, although he accomplished quite a bit for open skies. Anyway, what I think this means is we're a bit behind, but it's actually good, because we'll do the next panel, and then we'll find a way to have Karan and Ambassador Pitsuan combine for our luncheon discussion, since the ambassador will be arriving on the ANA flight and get here in time for that. So we're 15 minutes late, but it works out well. Also, Chairman Hayashi's presentation this morning was outstanding, and I think we'll have copies available in hard copy and then on our website, but it raises, or at least for me, a lot of interesting questions as well. So Chairman Hayashi has agreed when we do the next panel also to answer questions on that presentation if you have them. But for now, we'll take a 10-minute break for coffee and then resume with the panel after that. Thank you.